Thank you guys. No Joe Panesco. Joe, do you want to give a shout out?
In between bites of my late lunch, absolutely. Hello, everybody.
And I would appreciate it very much. We got a number of Habitat pros to introduce themselves as well.
This is Tara Rentz, Ecosystem Services Division Manager. Good to see you all.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Tom Jamison. I'm the Fish Passage and Screening Division Manager.
Hi, all. My name is Gabrielle Stillwater, and I am the Fish Passage and Policy Rulemaker.
Hi, everybody. Randy Thurston, Protection Division Manager.
And I think that goes through all staff. Do we have any guests or any other staff who would like to introduce themselves? I think I see a few folks over there. Nikki, are they able to introduce themselves?
If they're panelists, yes, they should be able to. If they're attendees, no.
And I'll just announce that one of our other AAGs, Randy Trick, is in as an attendee listening in. He is one of the newer AAGs who is joining our team of attorneys who assist on HPA matters. Lauren Kerrigan is the other AAG who is currently the lead for the program.
And I think I recognize two other folks who are currently signed in as attendees. I believe that's Dr. Tim Quinn, who's the chief scientist for the Habitat program, listening in. He's had quite a bit of involvement in most of these topics on one level or another. And Teresa Nation is one of the senior planners working in our protection division, focused on HPAs and HPA implementation. So she also has had quite a bit of involvement in a number of the topics that we're going to talk about today. So we've got a nice full house. With that, and please let me know if, again, I still feel like I'm learning the protocols of these committees, but I wanted to let you know that, so the agenda that we've got in front of us today, I think is mostly focused on you guys as the Habitat Committee members, getting you up to speed on some big conservation issues that the department's involved in that are have the potential for big conservation impact and benefit. With the exception of closing out any remaining questions that you have about the civil rules that you voted on in your last call, the three remaining items are items that are starting up. They're on the upswing. And we mostly wanted to focus on giving you guys kind of a foundational understanding and education about those issues, knowing that they either will come before you and the full commission as rules in the future or as big conservation topics. And maybe I will pause right there. Director, Amy, Jeff, is there anything else you want to say big picture about our intent today to build this committee's role?
Nothing for me. I think you've outlined it. So let's just jump in.
All right, let's roll. The first item, so you really grateful for all the work that you all did and the vote you took last call around HPA civil rulemaking. We just have a few steps to complete that rulemaking, and I'm going to ask Randy to just summarize the last couple remaining procedural details. We weren't intending to have a long presentation here, but just wanted to make sure there was a place if any of you have any remaining questions after he goes through the basic steps that remain. Randy, you want to go ahead and summarize?
I'm here. It wasn't working. I don't know, but Tess sent a new link, and I could see you guys, but you couldn't see me. But I'm used to that in life. You know, nobody responds.
It's the...
Good to have you on board, Brad.
Well, it's a pleasure to see you all.
Greetings these days. Welcome. Excellent. Well, Randy was just going to summarize a few basic remaining.
Morgan, you kind of cut out there a little bit, but I think I get the gist. As Morgan said, we're just wrapping things up in one sense and starting new work in another. But we've got the CR103 has been reviewed internally and it's ready to go. So hopefully we're going to file that next week. The rules will then become effective 31 days after we file. But we won't be ready to implement at that time until we actually have a program in place to implement the civil compliance rules. There is a communication plan that I've been working on with our public affairs staff. So we'll be doing a lot of outreach in the next couple of weeks to internally and externally to folks that are interested in civil compliance, contractors that are working on bulkheads in particular because some of the rules affected them. And then also, and just in general, to the regulated community. So, with that, we'll hopefully get started implementing our implementation plan, which has us doing some education outreach to staff and also to the regulated community. Is there any questions I can answer?
All right. Well, I'm excited, as I mentioned in our last conversation, we are hiring a compliance division manager. So to the degree it's helpful for us to talk about implementation of that program over time, as we start to shape it up as a program, we'll have a brand new division manager to come and talk with us about that. If it's okay to keep going, the next topic that we have on the agenda, I have to apologize first. I didn't write out the title entirely correctly. What we wanted to do was to give you an update on implementation of House Bill 1261, which is actually a bill relating to all motorized mineral prospecting, not just suction dredging. So I apologize for that. That was my mistake in sending notes to Nikki. This bill, the reason, again, we're just starting to begin getting ready for implementation in coordination with the Department of Ecology, who has a really big role in this bill. But the reason that we wanted to bring it before you is, as you know from your work so far, mineral prospecting is an important issue. Our state, and you may recall that there were a number of folks working over several sessions to try to pass a bill related to mineral prospecting and how it pertains to salmon recovery and conservation of fish. So this bill did in fact pass. I believe it becomes effective on June 11th. Trout Unlimited, Fish Not Gold, and a number of other organizations have been really active in this bill and with the legislature, and also in reaching out to Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Ecology. And so we wanted to make sure that you all have a basic understanding of the bill itself and what the bill does. And so again, our main objective today was to run you through some basic background material and the start that we've got on frequently asked questions, so you guys have that strong foundation. I think now Randy Thurston is here to help me with this one. She and her team have been really active so far with the Department of Ecology. And we have a little one pager or two pager to run you through. Randy, would you like me to pull that up on share my screen? And you can let me and we can roll through it that way.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Bear with me for just a minute. All right, are you guys able to see this document?
Can you zoom in just a little bit?
I sure can, yep. Let's see. And how's that? Is there anything blocking there for you guys? Looks okay?
Yeah, looks good here.
It's good.
All right. So I have run through a little bit of this background material, And Randy and I didn't do a ton of practice on how we wanted to coordinate back and forth here. But as I said, this is related, and you can see this starting in the definitions. This is related to all motorized or gravity siphon aquatic mining. That's kind of the scope of this. This law goes into effect on June 11th, and as you see up there in the explanation, the basic intent of the bill was to ban motorized and gravity siphon mining in all areas that have already been designated as being critical for salmon steelhead. Randy, I'm having a little bit of trouble on my end with sound. Would you mind stepping in to run through some of the basic scope and some of what we've done already to coordinate in advance of June 11th with the Department of Ecology and existing permit holders?
Sure. In addition to banning the activity in critical habitat, it also bans this activity in it's called designated use areas, and these are areas that are identified in ecology's rules as areas where salmon or salmonids, so that would include trout, spawn, rear, and migrate. So it's a little broader than just the ESA critical habitat area. And then those areas that aren't designated as critical habitat or those use areas, this activity could be allowed, but they would need what's called a National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit, or NPDS permit. It's a water quality permit from ecology before they could do that. And then that permit would also have to be sent to us as part of a complete application for an HPA for this activity as well. So in order to do that, one of the things that we have to do is we have to take the remaining motorized methods out of the Golden Fish pamphlet and require individual HPAs for those, so that we can require that NPDS permit gets submitted as part of that application. So we'll be doing that. And so on June 11th, the Gold and Fish pamphlet will be modified to have those activities removed. The only thing that will remain are those activities that are going to fit under that new definition of small-scale mining, which I think is under the gravity, motorized and gravity siphon mining definition. And they're all non-motorized activities, so real small-scale. So we've been working with ecology on a communication plan. I think we've identified over 20 entities to reach out to and communicate with on this rulemaking. And we'll start reaching out to staff next week and then follow that up with key stakeholders. We do have some frequently asked questions that we're still working on with ecology, but this will kind of be the foundation for some information that gets put on our websites, both Ecology and WDFWs.
Sorry for jumping in, just wanted to add, we can go through some of these basic questions. I think the important, one of the important points I'm realizing we wanted to make sure that you know, building on what Randy said, there has been some confusion, because I think some people have believed that once this bill passed, that it would mean that mineral prospecting is banned also under WDFW's authorities. Mm-hmm. And what the actual effect of the bill was by directing ecology to use their water quality authority in this way, and by banning this activity from being able to get water quality authorization in those waters. Mineral prospectors will not be. Oof, sorry about that, you guys. I'll turn it back to Randy. Randy, can you speak to the difference between what DFW can do and what ecology can do?
Right. Yeah, I can do that. So most of the changes affected ecology's statutes. And the ban on this activity is actually a ban from ecology issuing an NPDES permit for this activity in those critical habitats or designated use waters. So so that's how the ban will be implemented. It didn't change our authority to issue HPAs. The only change to our authority was that now after June 11th, we have to require an NPDES permit before we can issue a permit, before we can issue an HPA. So Margaret's highlighting. As a result of that, there's been some confusion from the environmental community. They thought that the statute gave us the ability, for example, to revoke existing HPAs that we have issued already. Then the statute did not give us any authority to rescind or modify or revoke those permits. So those permits would still be active. They're still out there. But in order to comply with both our statute and ecology statute, they wouldn't be able to do this activity because they wouldn't have an NPDES permit from ecology after June 11th. So it's not as clean or easy as it could have been had the legislature said, and Fish and Wildlife, you will revoke all the permits that you have in place. Hopefully we can make it understandable when we're communicating this to the mining community in particular.
Hey, Randy, this is Jeff. Along those lines, so golden fish will be changed, right? And that's
yes, golden fish will be changed.
The majority of the mineral prospectors we have out there that would be affected by this, but mm-hmm. can remind us, like, that we do have a number of individual HPAs, and that's really what you're speaking to, isn't it?
Right. We have a little, I can't remember the exact number offhand. It's there's around 400, maybe a little more, individual HPAs that are active right now.
And do we have a sense of when those go away, right? Those are typically up to 5-year HPAs. Do we have a sense of when those will be expiring and going away permanently?
We don't. I don't have numbers as to, like, 20% will expire this year and so many will expire next year. What I do know is, as part of our outreach, ecology will be sending a letter to all those permit holders to let them know that it's not lawful for them to work unless they have an NPDES permit. I think those that won't qualify for an NPDES permit, I think it's ecology's attention to say, and you're in an area that we can't issue this, therefore this activity is not going to be, you can't do this activity lawfully. So.
This is Morgan. So that's one of the reasons, hopefully you can hear me. That's one of the reasons the coordination with ecology has been so important. We mm-hmm. are trying to make sure they have that information about who permit holders are.
This is Joe Panesco. So, can I ask a question of Randy?
Of course.
Sure.
So the ecology law says they can't give a Clean Water Act permit mm-hmm. for designated critical habitat. And that's a pretty concrete conceptual thing that I presume has maps with it and everything else. But it also has this broader language in it, designated use areas uh-huh. where salmonids spawn, rear, and migrate. First question, does ecology have presently designated use areas where it's clear which water bodies are in or out? Or are they planning on coming up with something how are they going to approach that definitionally? Because my worry for agency enforcement, really more ecology, mm-hmm. is ambiguity over which waters might have salmonid spawning in it.
Yeah.
My sense is not always clear cut.
Yeah, they do have a map tool right now on their website. But what they'd like to do, and they're working on, is actually providing a list of water bodies and letting, and so that in addition, so people could go to that as well by county and see if they're in or out. So they're going to have, they'll have, hopefully have both tools available is the, is what I understand. They don't currently have that list. So they're working on that. So I don't know if it'll be done by June 11th or not, but hopefully it will. But they do have a map, a mapping program, like a GIS layer.
Yeah, I can ultimately see the suction dredge mining community really pushing that point with ecology. Mm-hmm. To the extent they claim that there's headwaters that are above the reach of any salmon spawning, that they still want to try to continue mining.
Well, according to ecology, they said if it's that if it's a designated use water body, that would include the headwaters. So it's going to be interesting.
So, Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Unless the is there more to the presentation? I'll wait to the end.
No, this is Margan. This is the basics that we wanted to get to you today. We will be, as Jeff clarified in his question earlier, we will be bringing motorized methods from the pamphlet. The only way we can check to see if they have that Clean Water Act permission is by seeing the individual permit applications. And so that's the change we have to make in order to meet the bill's new requirement that we see whether they have that water quality authorization before we can call their application for a permit complete. But that's the end of our presentation, Commissioner Kehoe.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I proceed?
Yes, go ahead.
So, you know, kind of refresh my recollection and some of the other commissioners. We did, I don't know, a couple years ago, we initiated rulemaking and did pass rules taking this motorized suction dredge activity out of the golden fish pamphlet, correct?
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And so now, and I think Jeff alluded to that, there are what, some 400 permits now that have been issued, mm-hmm. HPA permits?
Mm-hmm. Most of those are from suction dredging.
I assume, do you happen to know off the top of your head how many of those permits would be impacted by this? Specifically, how many are in these areas where you can no longer legally carry on this activity?
So, according to the ecology planner that's been working this, he looked at all of the permits and cross-referenced their locations against their GIS layer and determined only two of the permits that we have in place would currently be able to move up. A person could work under the only two of the permits. The rest are in either the critical habitat or the designated use area.
Okay, good. So a couple more questions then. And just so I'm clear, I understand this. So as of June 11, ecology, not WDFW, will be contacting these folks, all but two, mm-hmm. and telling them that their HPA permit is no longer valid, or I shouldn't say not their HPA permit is no longer valid, but rather the activity is no longer valid, even though they do have an HPA permit. Is that how it's going to work?
Yeah, they'll contact them and let them know that that the work would require their, you know, the ecology's permit, but they cannot issue the permit because the work's occurring in one of those two areas where it's banned.
So that they can't issue the permit. And so that means as of whenever this bill goes into effect, they cannot engage in this activity where they have a permit for.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I imagine we'll have some folks coming to us in coming meetings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me follow up on on that comment, because they are a very active and participatory group of individuals. Have you heard a lot from them?
You know, surprisingly not. I wasn't over during the testimony, and Pat Chapman actually listened into the hearings. But I understand that there wasn't a lot of participation in the hearings at the legislature for this bill either. I think, and I don't know why, because like you said, they've been very active in the past. I think one of the things that they may not have understood is how far-reaching this bill is. There might have been a misconception that's just affected suction dredging, for example, and not all the other motorized methods that they use. But I don't know that for a fact. I'm speculating here. So, but I was surprised, and really to date, I've only heard from one person, one person from the prospecting community, and ecology really hasn't been contacted by them either. So, in this case, I don't think silence is golden. I think, so.
And then one more question, follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair, and then I'll yield to everybody else. So, is there going to be a complicated rulemaking process for our agency to implement this, or is just a small kind of rulemaking, or is there any rulemaking at all for us?
We are going to have to do rulemaking. I don't think it's complicated. Any rulemaking we do seems complicated, but I don't think it's more complicated. I think it's adding those two new definitions, or one new definition. There's a change to the other definition, making those changes, and then removing those other motorized methods from the rules that govern the pamphlet, and sticking them in a different section. So not a lot of technical rule writing, mostly just reorganization.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff.
Yeah, Jeff.
Yeah, I just want to point out, we're throwing around the word ban, and that may be the case for the mechanized prospecting. But these folks can still access these claims for panning. Is that not correct, Randy?
Yeah, that's correct. So they can use non-motorized methods.
And are all of the sluices, are they all mechanized? Or are there ones that are hand operated?
I think there are some that you can actually put into the stream, and the stream water actually kind of washes the material through the riffles that capture the gold. So I think there are some that aren't motorized. But things like the high bankers that folks use, those are, that kind of equipment wouldn't be allowed in these areas.
So it would be clear to the public the difference between a mechanized and a non-mechanized, right?
Hopefully from the definition, and then also we'll have the non-motorized, non-mechanized methods still in the Golden Fish pamphlet, so we'll make it clearer in the pamphlet what's authorized.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So commissioners, as we were saying earlier, our objective was to get you some of this basic factual information early, knowing we will have to do that rulemaking as simple as we hope to make it. I want to make sure we get to the other two remaining items, but do you have any other questions about this bill or about the relationship of Fish and Wildlife's piece of implementation, or anything else to help you begin thinking about this in advance of action by the commission?
I'm fine.
No, I appreciate the update. I do know that this bill was kicking around in the legislature this session, and I did know that it passed, and so I appreciate the update. And I think it's a good thing that we have our sister agency, Ecology, involved in this. Director Suswin, your former agency, we often got criticized, we meaning the department, as far as not having a Clean Water Act kind of connection with our revised rules. So now that this takes care of that criticism. So,
right.
All right. Mr. Chair, if there are no more questions, is it all right for you if we move on to the next agenda item?
Yeah, great, Martin. Please do.
And many thanks to Randy. As you guys already know from your interactions, she and her team do excellent work, and there's sort of no rest for the weary when it comes to HPA. So.
Well, after our meeting the other day, Randy was taking center stage. So given all this great work, Randy, don't show up at the office for a few days. Stay home and work. Oh,
thank you. Appreciate it.
That's very generous.
Does that apply to me too, Brad?
No. Okay. You're still in Spain. What the hell are you talking
about? No, that's true.
All right. Well, the next item that we wanted to bring before you that's on the agenda is, again, to give you some additional basic information and an overview on fish passage and screening rulemaking. I believe I've mentioned this in passing before, but before we go into details, I'll just reiterate that I think as you have likely tracked over the last several years, the short version is that fish passage and screening have become really important. Gabriel, I'm glad you're here, and Tom. Gabriel, if my sound is terrible, I could use your help going through the presentation. Jeff or Kelly, is there anything you'd like to say big picture about fish passage before we talk a little bit about the rulemaking?
It's super important. Fish have to get to the habitat, and we need to keep them in the river and out of irrigation systems.
Good science.
Wow, I wasn't sure I had anything positive to ask, Ed, but Jeff covered it.
Well, I'm going to share again here. Let's see.
Maybe, Morgan, while you're getting that set up, sorry for being crass about it. I just maybe remind us all that there's tens of thousands of barriers blocking habitat, either fully blocking or partially blocking. And so as you all and the agency navigates like salmon fisheries or steelhead issues, the amount of actual available habitat for freshwater productivity is really compromised by these barriers. And if we don't have irrigation diversions or municipal water diversions screened, then they're also an attractive nuisance for pulling fish out of the systems. And so we lose them as part of the juvenile and certainly the adult return. So this is a really big deal, a big contributing factor to a lot of the challenges we face as an agency with salmon recovery and more increasingly difficult north of Falcon conversation. So it's something that you could make a lot of hay once we get good rules in place. And hopefully at some point we'll see a even more significant public and private investment in getting these things out of the way so that we can truly get salmon and steelhead back to all the habitat that we're out there restoring and protecting already.
Yeah, that, you know, that's a good point, Jeff. And, you know, we talk about fish passage or non-passage. You know, the conversation typically is about culverts. But, you know, these rules, when they're adopted, I assume will be much broader than culverts, right?
That's right. And I pulled up the slide that talks a little bit about the scope of the rulemaking. But yes, I think the focus has been on culverts, maybe largely because of the federal culvert injunction. But it's true, as Jeff said, that the challenges to passage and the challenges to pulling fish into water diversions are much broader than culverts. And we've got some existing programs and guidance to help with that. Were there any more big picture questions? I didn't mean to officially sort of cut you off there, Commissioner Kehoe.
No.
All right. Well, I think the simplicity and yet the magnitude of the potential positive impact is really easy for lay people to grasp. And it was definitely easy for the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force to grasp. So although the agency hasn't developed rules for this statute, the statute's been in place since the mid-40s, 1940s. And although we didn't have rules, we've had a fairly robust program of identifying and correcting both passage barriers and screening problems for many decades. The Southern Resident Orca Task Force identified fish passage and screening rulemaking as one of the improvements that could make it more clear to the public what the rules are and make it more clear to the public what the consequences of non-compliance are. So this was direction that we got from the legislature during the last long session to go ahead and create rules around the RCWs that you see in front of you. If you're ever interested and you like to read statutes in your spare time, this one's pretty straightforward. Commissioner Baker, I saw you shake your head. I know you must love to read these things. It's a fairly short one. It's actually only two or so pages in our compiled rule book, which is nice. You can kind of grasp it all in one piece. The only parts of 7757 that we are proposing to not include, 7757020, which deals with Department of Fish and Wildlife support to the Department of Ecology around their water rights program, and 7757080, which has some specific direction to the agency about the Toutle River. So what you see in front of you is the scope of the rulemaking, and I'm not going to go into the details here, but basically structures, passage for structures that cross the water. Well, I guess I could go in order. Fish guards is the part that speaks to screening. Fishways in 030 talks about when there are larger obstructions, you've got to provide an effective, what we often call a fish ladder or a fishway. And one of the interesting things about this statute is that, as I said, it's fairly straightforward, but because it was written in the 1940s, some of the language is a little bit archaic. Our main goal, it's taken us a little while to get started on this rule. Again, it legislative session, and it took us some time to scope
scope the rulemaking and to bring Gabriel Stillwater on board to really lead this for us. But our main goals are to take the programs that we already have in place and really codify those current standards for water crossings, for which are the in-stream structures, for screening. And another piece that has been a discussion among Kelly and myself and Jeff and others is making sure that the structures that we permit and put in place will continue to pass fish over time, even given what we know about climate change and its effect on streams.
Yeah. Morgan, just a quick question. Going back to the ORCA task force meetings and the controversy and emotion around the Snake River dams, do the Snake River dams come into play in any of this? I mean, are they mentioned?
Not at all in the direction to us from the legislature. Not for this exact piece. I believe there were other ORCA task force recommendations that the governor's office is taking the lead on in terms of scoping the Snake River Dam situation. Amy, I know you were our representative to that task force. Is there anything you want to add or clarify about where and how Snake River Dams have come into this?
Yeah, I don't think they touch this, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Yeah. I know for sure they didn't touch this rulemaking, but that doesn't mean that there won't be, this rulemaking is going to be a big deal. I'll just be really plain with it. It's a big topic because, as Commissioner Kehoe noted, it's not just about culverts, which have enough interest and passion around them by themselves, but it's all the structures that we have in place as a result of the human influence on the landscape that affect whether fish are able to get to the places that they would like to get to spawn and rear. And so I suspect that, and we have a slide, just one more, talking about our initial thinking about the process, but we're expecting a lot of energy, a lot of interest from the public partners and from tribes. And we're expecting that to come out. And so we really are anticipating a robust public process and have hired a consultant to help us as a facilitator, organizing and facilitating the tribal consultation and public outreach meetings.
Okay, just one last question. Has Tom Davis been weighing in on any of this to this point?
No, not specifically on this one. I think, and that may change as we begin to do additional outreach. But from some conversations that I've had with Tom in the past, for the most part, I think we have a very good relationship with agricultural communities, because part of our existing programs and that existing approach that we really want to codify in these rules is we bring a lot of technical assistance and financial incentives to agricultural landowners and communities where they have a concern about certainly screening or fish passage, that we're bringing assistance. So I think many of our interactions have been very positive. I suspect that we would hear from Tom and the Farm Bureau and others around this point about climate adaptation. I think that one of the things we'll have to look at is we know it's important to make sure that when you spend a bunch of money on infrastructure, it continues to meet the standard over time. But we'll have to do some analysis to make sure that we understand cost implications, where our knowledge about how a stream width or stream flow will change over time means we need to consider a larger structure. We understand that has a cost implication. And so that's going to be a big part of this rulemaking as well.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So one quick final point on this slide. Our goal, so one of the questions that we have, and we're working with Joe Panesco and his team, you guys are probably recall that from your work on HPA civil rules, that there is another statute 4305 that directs Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Ecology, and Department of Natural Resources to use a technical assistance in compliance first and really help people comply with the law. And so we're doing some, that's the intent and the approach that we want to bring into this rulemaking as well. And so we're doing research to try to make sure we understand how we can pull in that language and sort of parallel rules.
So again, we're losing you, Margaret.
Gabriel, if you're on the line, could you take yourself off mute and talk a little bit about this draft timeline?
There we go. Sorry, it took me a second to unmute myself. Yes, so I can run you guys through this really quick. Right now, kind of our limiting factors within this is since we were directed in the budget to develop rules, we're kind of working within the timeline and scope that they gave us. So this could be a little bit ambitious, but my goal and focus through this process was to make sure that we are doing the best that we can to accomplish this in the timeline that the legislature has set forth. So currently we are in the pre-CR 101 phase. As Margan mentioned, we did hire a facilitator to bring on to help with those discussions that we're going to be having with our tribal partners and our other targeted stakeholders. And we'll be doing some initial outreach just to let them know what our process is going to be and that we're in fact going to be making rules on this statute, just so it doesn't come as a surprise. Before we do eventually file our CR 101, I had originally hoped to have that filed right about now, but given COVID-19, it's really kind of adjusted the timeline that we have. And it's something that we're going to need to consider moving forward through this process and be flexible in adjusting to that to make sure that our outreach is inclusive and comprehensive and that the people that we're interacting with have an opportunity to speak and be heard, and that we can really work to understand considerations, both, you know, what we're planning on doing, but things that we haven't considered before as well, and really work towards a good process there. So once we do file that CR 101, we'll begin the official outreach period for that. And within that, we'll start working on the proposed rule language. And then once we have that in order, of course, it'll be the State Environmental Policy Act, as well as looking towards the Regulatory Fairness Act development as well. So those are all the things that will kind of be going on simultaneously with that process. And once we're at a good point with all of that, then we'll move forward with our CR 102. I'm hoping to have that ready between January and May of next year. The reason why you stop seeing specific dates is that the Code Revisor's Office has not released their schedule for 2021 and beyond. So I'm just putting kind of a rough time frame around that as well. I'm being, you know, aware of the filing deadlines that we have to meet once we do start filing the CR 102s for that. So once we hit our CR 102, we'll be moving into the public comment period and hearings, the adoptions, and making sure we develop the concise explanatory statement. And then hopefully having the CR 103 happen between June and November before the end of 2021 after that. So.
Thank you, Gabriel. I'm so glad that you're here. Thanks for stepping in. Hopefully you guys can hear me. Are there any questions about this rulemaking? Or I guess I could go back up to the process slide. Again, we're coming to you at a really early stage, but we wanted to begin giving you time to get up to speed and think about this important issue. I suspect we'll get a lot of public involvement, probably a lot of coordination in our consultation with our tribal partners. So you'll be seeing more of this moving forward.
So this is Commissioner Kehoe. I have just a comment and maybe a question or request to.
Yeah, Bob.
So this language from the legislature I would be interested in seeing it. Was it contained in a budget proviso?
It was. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I think it would be useful to see what that language is.
Certainly.
Just so the rest of the commission could, you know, has an idea of what the direction is, because that will help us, I think, you know, help you in moving forward in the rulemaking. And then the other related question, was there any money allocated by the legislature for this endeavor?
Those are great comment and questions. So we'll get you that language. The language that's actually in the budget proviso is just a few words referencing the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force items that they were intending to fund. So we'll get you both that appropriation language, but we'll also get you the language from the task force itself, which is really where the content and direction, I think, about the rulemaking comes from. So we'll get that for you. And as you asked, yes, they did give the agency kind of a lump sum for a number of different Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force items. This one, we had submitted a fiscal note, and because we anticipated this is a pretty big rulemaking, we used our HPA major rulemaking as a model. And the costs we're anticipating are Gabriel's time being a lead person and project manager for the project, the facilitation services that I mentioned, and then, as you guys know from major rulemakings and your familiarity with HPA work, there will be some big products like a cost-benefit analysis, a small business economic impact statement analysis. And so the remainder of the money is identified for those products to support this rulemaking.
Okay, good. And, you know, just one last thing, too. I think a valuable partner in this, and I think Brad would agree with me on this, are the local RFEGs throughout the state, regional fishery enhancement groups, I think is the term. And
right,
you know, they're very active. They're the kind of the local experts, I think, in many regards, to kind of areas where there could be improvement for fish passage. So probably already thought of that, but that just sounds like a really good partnership.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, and I have been an advocate for that group, because those groups throughout the state are very diverse. You have all sectors sitting around their table. So it's a great way to leverage, the Farm Bureau, all sorts of other groups that they already have great bridges built with all of those. So they're a good ally.
Absolutely. One of the things we can do the next time we're before you, bringing you a little bit more detail about our...
Okay.
...approach and what we're hearing is just to make sure that the feedback we're getting and the reactions we're getting about the rules are as equitable and sort of full as possible.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Other questions? Does that wrap that one up, Martin?
That does, yeah. And many thanks again to Gabriel and Tom Jameson as the division manager. This one will be big and it'll be a heavy lift, and they're really diving in now. So I appreciate that. Thank you both. All right, so we just got a few more minutes. I think half an hour, we may be able to wrap this one up before 3, but I think I've mentioned before how important the health of riparian ecosystems is to our conservation goals, and really, I would say, the future of fish and wildlife in the state, particularly given what we're learning about full and healthy riparian ecosystems in the state, is a really important way we can make sure that we'll continue to have both terrestrial wildlife as well as the best chance at having all the fish species that we want over time. And what I wanted to do is I have a couple slides, and I wanted to speak with you specifically about a project we've got in Habitat Program related to our riparian guidelines. But before I go there, I just want to, this topic of riparian ecosystem health is one of those conservation policy topics that just is cropping up in a lot of different places. It's important to us, it's important to tribes and conservation partners, but the very same places that that riparian ecosystems would typically exist are also important places for people, for agriculture, and for cities. And so what Washington's approach or approaches are going to be to manage riparian ecosystems is really a big deal. It's a big deal for fish and wildlife and a big deal for people as well. I think we may have told you that Western Washington tribes for the last several years have been asking the governor in the annual Centennial Accord Forum to say more about what the state's approach to protecting and restoring riparian ecosystems is going to be. And last November 2019 at the Centennial Accord, the governor made a commitment that he was going to bring the executive branch together and bring the executive branch together with tribal governments to dig into that topic more and figure out how Washington and the executive branch can do better about around riparian ecosystem protection and restoration. It's really exciting and a lot of really a lot of leadership by the governor and the governor's office to make that commitment. It's also been terribly complicated to make progress on that. We had a meeting that I think was scheduled for March 25th before all this COVID business hit us. And clearly it's not appropriate to bring tribal elected leaders and a bunch of people together in a room. So that meeting has been postponed. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Director Suze Wind, to Jeff. They really have been good, balanced advocates talking about the importance of riparian ecosystems, really listening to what tribal co-managers have to say about riparian ecosystems and trying to navigate those tricky waters. Kelly or Jeff, is there anything that you would like to say at the beginning just about riparian, our work in the riparian arena in general? Most of the remainder of what I had prepared was giving the commission an update on the PHS riparian guidance document specifically and how we're marching to completion there. So I don't want to skip past the big picture too quickly.
Thanks, Morgan. Well, I, you know, of all the ecosystems that exist in Washington State, the riparian, by all accounts, is the most important ecosystem. Tara's probably still on here. I think it's like 85% of wildlife species in the state of Washington utilize riparian ecosystems for some aspect or all aspects of their life history. So this, you know, when you think about our mandate of preserve, protect, perpetuate, and manage, this is a habitat area that has been impacted across the landscape. A lot of us are working really diligently to restore it, and the agencies involved in efforts to try to more effectively protect it in working with local governments and tribes and our sister agencies moving forward. So these things are also really connected to what needs to happen regarding the changing climate. So it's there's mutual benefits here, but as Morgan mentioned, there's controversy to this, even within the state family, around certain programs have different standards than maybe fish and wildlife need, and so It's not, it hasn't been easy. It won't get any easier, but it's really super important for a whole host of reasons moving forward. So.
Hey, Margan, this is Barbara.
Yes.
I sure don't want to short circuit an important topic, but do you mind trying to be done maybe 5 minutes before three? Because a bunch of us have to get on another one of these at three and might be good to take a real short break.
Absolutely. I think I can do better than that even.
Okay, thanks.
And before we do jump off, I want to make sure, because I'm on that 3 o'clock test, if you could send me the second link, not the first link, so I don't have that getting on problems. Or somebody?
Gotcha, Brad. Nobody wants me.
I'll send you the link, Brad.
We'll try to give you plenty of time to get back on that next one. Before, I think what I'm going to do is just maybe show you one or two slides. And before I do that real quick, there have been a lot of people working on this particular topic for a really long time, a few of which are on the line today. It's gone on long enough that a few of us have changed roles over time and had touch points and come back. That's certainly true for myself. Amy Windrop had a role when she was the Ecosystem Services Division Manager. Dr. Tim Quinn has had a strong role in this over time. Jeff still does because of the strong policy role. And Tara Rentz, who's on the phone, who's our Ecosystem Services Division Manager, has also played a strong role. So many thanks to those folks wading through this complicated topic really for quite a long time. So I'm going to share my screen, and I'll start at the end first. So just reiterating what I've said, this has been nearly a 10-year-long effort, and the policy issues didn't seem maybe quite so broad or complicated when we first started it. When I say project, what I'm really talking about is, as you all likely know, the department creates a lot of guidelines that are intended to take what we know about fish and wildlife and their habitats and make it really accessible for people who want to do better at protecting and restoring those resources. Hopefully you guys are familiar with our Priority Habitats and Species program, which is a program the Habitat program leads to really do just that. Get our fish and wildlife information and science into the hands of the people who affect land use. And certainly that's local governments, but it's individual landowners, land trusts, and others. Really what we're talking about right now, we created a document in 2018 that revised the science, or reprised maybe the science basis upon which our guidelines are based. And that science document was completed a couple years ago. It was peer-reviewed through the Washington State Academy of Sciences and has been in place for a while. And that really summarizes the science of what riparian ecosystems contribute to and aquatic fish and wildlife. What we actually call Volume 2 is our effort to take the science, and based on what the science says, tell people what we think that means in terms of the choices they should make about managing riparian ecosystems. And that's been out for public review once already, and we've really spent about the last year responding to those comments, changing the document itself, and we're hoping to get to completion in June of this year. I'm going backwards through the presentation here, but the reason I called that out, the reason I think we've taken a year and a half to revise the document is that our operating environment has changed. The focus that the governor has had and that you all as a commission have had on conservation and doing better around conservation. The fact that
you have helped us now have a director who's very focused on conservation and the long-term benefits to game species, to watchable wildlife, and to wildlife in general, has really helped us clarify what our purpose is in this document as we look at riparian ecosystems. And so when we look through the lens of our mandate, preserve, protect, and perpetuate, what we come away with based on the science is that those riparian ecosystems are so important to the future of Washington's fish and wildlife that we value the protection and restoration of healthy, intact, fully functioning riparian ecosystems statewide. Now, the reason I call this out, and it's the point I want to leave you with, is that guidance documents we've had in the past have sort of made compromises about how much protection is really needed, and a lot of focus in the past has been on riparian ecosystems really just as buffers to a stream. And the approach that we've taken in this document, in the revision of this document, has been to be very clear about kind of protection and restoration and riparian management measures give us the greatest confidence in meeting our mandate to ensure the protection and perpetuation of fish and wildlife over time. We also understand that guidance document that's very narrowly focused on fish and wildlife and what's best for fish and wildlife is going to be brought into a lot of other policy conversations where there's other considerations, whether that be a growing community or an urban environment or working lands. And so I guess I'll leave you with this purpose and philosophy, and because maybe just stop there and see if you have any questions or any requests for us when we come back to talk with you more about this guidance document, if there are particular aspects of it that you guys really want to make sure you understand as a Habitat Committee.
So does that wrap up your part, Morgan? You open for questions now?
Yeah, this wraps up our part. We're open for questions. And again, I've got a lot of other subject matter experts here on the line at your disposal.
Okay, and recognizing the time factor, commissioners, any questions? This is all good stuff. Good visuals too. Barb, go ahead.
I just want to say I think this is actually a wonderful way to leave this meeting because it's a perfect segue into our next meeting, which is kind of starting to go over our strategic plan, which is coming together. So thanks very much, Morgan. I assume it's based on both history and relationships that you and Jeff are working together on this stuff.
That's definitely true. I think this is a great example of an issue that's an issue for our strategic plan and the future of the agency. And rightfully so, your director of conservation is really focused on it as an important lever to pull for conservation. Also huge connections then to implementation and making it real inside Habitat Program. And a big shout out to Tara Rents on the visuals and the presentation. We'll try to keep it interesting.
It's hard to have a bad picture of a wood duck, a drake.
Well, thanks, you guys. I don't want to cut off your conversation, but I also want to respect your time for sure. And if you have other thoughts along the way about what you would like to hear about around riparian policy in the state, keep those suggestions coming. We'll make these committee meetings focused on what you want to hear about.
Great. Thank you, Morgan and Jeff. Thank you and all staff. Excellent job. It put a smile on my face on a rather bleak time period.
Okay, we'll see you soon.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thank you for your...
Bye-bye.
Thanks, thank you, Tara and Tim and Jeff and Tom.